Hey. Sinners. I'm in my bad boy mood. Because we're in the 50s now.
You sound bad. You sound very aloof.
If you you can't see this right now, but I got the slicky slick hair. I am recording this on the where is it? On the front of a what's a 50s car? I don't know anything about cars, so
just some old greaser.
Some old greaser vehicle.
Some old hot rod.
That's me. And Stevie, I don't think he approves.
I'm wearing my my polka dot dress with little velvet dogs.
Yikes.
I'm going to the sock hop tonight. That's a joke, folks. We're in the studio.
We're in the studio.
We're in normal clothing, but we feel like we're in the 50s, and so should you after what we've got to say today.
Mm-hmm. We've got a lot to say today. I think you guys are in for a good show, because like we said, going by decade, we were in the 40s last week, now we're here, 1950 onward, until 1959. So we got a list for you guys.
We got lists, like you said, upon lists.
Mm-hmm. And I'm going to dish it for you, okay?
This time we both got fives, right?
We got fives. We came here last time, we were just such a ragtag group, just recording out of a shack, it seemed like, you know. But now we're here in the fresh studio in New York City.
Not quite. We're in the Lesser Apple.
The Lesser Apple? The city that sometimes sleeps.
30 miles out of Denver,
sleeps?
Colorado.
Yeah.
The city that, you know, goes to sleep when it's appropriate. Right. Though it doesn't want to keep up the other cities. Has respect for boundaries.
Myself. So this, I feel like this is an easier episode. And you disagree.
I agree and I disagree. I agree in that there's more to work with, but mm-hmm. I think with the more you have to work with, the harder it becomes to decide.
Okay,
that's
agree.
What I've noticed.
All right, yeah. See, I found that, like, a lot of my favorites from the 40s were, you know, they're kind of scatter. You know, the 40s is a scatterbrained era, like we said. You know, it's a lot of, you know, it's not hard to discover a whole lot.
Yeah, know? Albums are not really cohesive.
Exactly. So the 50s, I feel like, you know, it's a little more of a streamlined industry at that point.
You yeah.
know, it's a little more cohesive. So with that, you know, it's funny, I always, you know, like to compare the 40s and 50s. They're very different. You know, there are similarities. But I feel like the cultural happenings of, you can talk about suburbia, suburban development in the 50s.
Yeah.
You can talk about,
we got the middle of the middle class. We got post-war mm-hmm. happiness is on the rise.
That's so true. And then you got, yeah, like you said, post-war and the nuclear scare. And I'm not going to act like I really know what I'm talking about here. Like,
we're stringing you guys along. We're very young. We've not been to the 50s.
I know. I kind of wish, though, much like the 40s, it is a time that I don't know, I connect with it somehow, you know? And I love the richness and the vibrant, you know, the colors of the 50s. You know what I mean?
So colorful. You had your diners, you had your milk shops, your malt shops.
Right.
You got your sock hops.
Yeah, it's a rollicking time.
You got your drive-ins.
Mm-hmm.
You get it all.
Right. And, you know, wherever those things were, that's the thing, is that music and movies, they were so integral into everyday culture in the 50s.
You got your jukebox.
You got your jukebox. So you find all these more accessible means of accessing media. You know, I know it's kind of silly to call it media back then. That's a goofy kind of word to use in anything,
it's all right.
But, you know,
it's all right.
The 90s
onward.
Gotta
do what you gotta do.
But no, really. And so, I mean, look at, like, you know, like young people in the 50s. You know, you see them in the movies, and where are they usually? They're at the drive-ins.
They're at the drive-in, or they're at the malt shop.
Or they're at the malt
shop.
Pumping
that jukebox.
Pumping it up. And, you know, what a time to have been young. You know, I'm sure.
Sure, yeah.
Yeah. We had a suggestion to have older people on the show, like, to recall, like...
The 50s.
The 50s and stuff like that. That'd be really cool, I feel like. We don't have that today.
No, we do not.
I wanted to spin a little surprise for you guys and say, we got old man
less. We got Chet.
We got Chet.
Chet is the typical 50s name.
Chet was a greaser. He's a...
We live in a Chet was either a greaser or Chet was more likely probably the captain of the football team.
Oh, man.
In his Letterman's jacket.
Either way, pretty intimidating, I must say.
Watch out for Chet. If you know a Chet, please watch out. When he listens to this episode, he will be invigorated.
Yeah.
He could come at you full force.
Well, speaking of people like Chet, I think people like Chet apply pretty well to music in the 50s. You know why? Because 40s had a kind of a gentleness about it, you know, vocally, sonically, overall. Sure. I feel like it did. And then the 50s comes along, what happens? Rock and roll.
Rock right? and roll. Rock in your world, and you're rolling down a hill.
Mm-hmm. So where does Chet come in? Well, Chet, being a macho guy himself, look at Elvis, okay? Look at his, you know, masculinity kind of come out in his music.
Yeah.
He kind of, it's, overtakes his image, you know what I mean?
Chet took the 40s to the drive-in.
Right.
And he taught it how to play ball. And that's where we're at.
That's pretty good. I'm going to end the episode there, actually. That was pretty good. I enjoyed that.
I feel like I channeled my inner Chet with that line.
Yeah, I mean, there's nothing more to say.
That wasn't me. Chet took over. The 50s is taking over already. We haven't even started.
We're all Chet.
I think it's a good place to start, though.
Yeah, this is good. Okay,
let's bring it to that coin toss.
All right.
Do you want to give me the honors? We have a special John Paul II coin.
Yeah.
Still a heads and tails. Heads being movies, tails being music. We'll see what we get.
I still theorize that it's going to be tails because of the weight on one end.
Well, and if you believe in the old saying, tails never fails.
Tail, that's such bunk. Get out of here.
We'll see. We'll see, guys. All right. See what we get.
Do
the old classic flip. We got heads.
You got heads. Great, that's a head. So now it was heads last time, wasn't it?
It was. So we're starting with movies again.
All right, well. Doing movies. Cool, I don't mind that, because...
You're the movies man.
That's right. Okay.
Do you want me to go first so you end up with the number one, since you're the movies guy?
Okay. That's very polite of you, Stevie. We're going to do that.
Okay.
We're gonna do that.
All right. So... similar to the 40s, I think my number five movie in the 40s was an Abbott and Costello.
I knew it. I asked you if there was Abbott and Costello on the list, and you said no.
No, you asked me a specific one, and I said no. Because the one I have on the list is Abbott and Costello Meet the Mummy. I mentioned it in the last episode that was my favorite. This one is hilarious.
What was I thinking?
I don't know what you were thinking. You said, not Jekyll and Hyde, you said...
I did say Jekyll.
You did say Jekyll and Hyde, yeah. I don't think I've even seen that. But really? The Mummy is so great. My favorite quote is Dr. Zuma, because they're running around looking for Dr. Zuma. And they find him. He's dead. He's dead in the house somewhere. He's falling on him out of a closet. And there's like tape recordings of his voice, so they think he's alive.
Mm-hmm.
I want to watch this movie again, because I saw that so many times as a kid.
I heard that Abbott and Costello, they wrote a lot of their material for... various kinds of things like beforehand.
Yeah.
Like it didn't let, like the dialogue didn't belong anywhere, but it made its way to like movies or sketches.
Would not
or something.
Surprise me. Those guys are off the wall.
They're off the wall.
Well, Costello is.
What about Abbott?
Abbott's the sensible straight man.
He's a straight man?
Yeah, but Abbott's definitely the straight man.
Well, what are you talking about though?
Because Costello's always yelling Abbott like every movie.
Yeah, I mean you got a point there, but like usually the sensible one comes, he's got second billing, right?
That's true. They flip, changed the game.
Yeah, you got your Holmes and Watson, like, you know, it's not right. That's
I don't
usually
know
how it goes, right? They don't ever say Watson.
Hey, just because he's a straight man doesn't mean he's
so
psychic.
Much better than Holmes and Watson.
Batman and Robin. It's not Robin and Batman,
but Robin is clearly not the sensible one there.
Not with that costume, right?
No.
All right.
Hey.
For all you fashionistas out there.
Yeah, poor Rob.
Alright, what do you have for number five?
Alright, my number five is... you'll never believe it. Forbidden Planet.
Forbidden Planet. Tell me about it. I haven't seen it.
I saw this actually back in high school. It was a sci-fi and fantasy class that I took. Like a nerd. But Forbidden Planet was kind of a pioneer in sci-fi movies for the time. And one reason it really stuck with me is the sound design is really intricate, and it's a lot of unique stuff going on. I mean, just sounds that I thought were never even possible to create.
Especially, yeah.
I mean, it's just so heavily electronic. You'll probably know Forbidden Planet in modern culture through Robbie the Robot. He's kind of a iconic figure. I know they took a lot of inspiration for him. We keep coming back to this game, but Fallout 3.
Oh, okay.
Fallout 3, actually, one of the service bots or something, very starkly resembles Robbie. And so Forbidden Planet is kind of a classic land on an alien planet. Nothing is really what as it seems, but what I like is that the foe in this movie, which is, you know, a humanoid, it's a human, really. I like that he is kind of plain. He's not really plain, he's actually a pretty illustrious kind of figure, but he's a rich kind of man. But I like that he's not a straight-up monster. You know what I mean? Okay. He's, I don't know, there's a certain sense of dread that comes along with familiarity and a villain, right?
Sure.
And so it's a pretty great movie. I, you know, can't say much else about it. It's actually been quite a while. The reasons that it's such a great movie, they really stuck with me. So
sure.
I really do enjoy it. And we're on to number four now.
My number four is a legendary movie, The Ten Commandments.
Great.
Cecil B. DeMille, if I'm saying that right.
Cecil.
It probably depends on where you come from. I've always thought it was Cecil. I don't know. Regardless, great movie. It's the classic tale, the Ten Commandments. And you got your plagues, and you got Moses, the burning bush. It's got some iconic scenes. The special effects they use when the spirit is going through, searching the doors, stopping at the lamb's blood. You got like a green, ghostly fog.
It's pretty scary. I remember seeing when I was young, and it kind of scared me as a kid. Like,
it was intense,
right? And you know, the Old Testament, I think, is so dark.
I think it's meant to scare you.
It is meant to. Yeah, and so I do like the sense of scale that it brings to movies. I mean, it was kind of like it was one of the first. You know, that like Lawrence of Arabia and a lot of movies of that type. I mean, you can't get that sense of scale with a lot of movies today because you see the limitations, right? And just, I mean, but that right there is it makes it all the more impressive.
They pushed it to the limits.
Exactly.
With, like, the parting of the seas, that's incredible. That's a great scene. I'll never forget that. Yeah. It was so cool.
Yeah. And you don't have to go far to see anything like that. I mean, that's ingrained in film history.
Yep.
I mean, and it's a great movie.
It's a long one.
It's a long one,
but
rightfully so.
Yeah, it's worth it.
It's got an intermission, doesn't it? I believe so.
It might. I wouldn't be surprised.
I'm a big intermission guy.
And Charlton Heston, right?
Charlton Heston, for sure.
We're all a big fan of him.
I sure am. Who did he play? No, I'm just kidding.
I got nervous for a second, and I was like, "Was he not in that movie?"
Pretty funny. Yeah.
All right. What do you got?
All right, my number four is Creature from the Black Lagoon.
Ooh.
Absolutely.
That's a classic.
I really love this movie. I had a little bit of an obsession with him when I was a kid.
He was such an original monster. He was so out there.
He was. You want to know my introduction to the character? This must have been like 1998 or 1999 or something. Burger King came out with a toy
the toys.
Line.
I remember those.
You remember those?
I had the Creature from the Black Lagoon toys.
Yeah.
I used it with a Playmobil island that I had.
Yeah.
With like a little dungeon and stuff. And he was swimming around the island.
Yeah.
All murky and menacing.
It's so cool. And I was so fascinated by this. I was like, this is amazing. And I went out and I asked my mom, hey, you know, as a little Andrew, like, hey, you know, what's up with this guy?
What is this green fellow?
This thing? And she said, why, it's the Creature of the Black Lagoon. And I said, the Creature of the Black Lagoon? Tell me all about it. And
I want to know more. Sign me up.
And I saw the movie, and it was just, it's a horrifying movie, I find. You know, some people say, oh, it's cheesy.
You know what? I think that adds to the appeal for me.
Yeah.
A lot of the, I mean, horror movies were so good in the 50s and 60s. Mm-hmm. And part of the appeal is that they are cheesy. Yeah. And there's no shame in that.
No. And the black and white certainly heightens the fear for me.
Yeah.
There's something about the imagery of, you know, the lake and the murkiness and him swimming and him emerging and haunting these people, these poor people.
And soon to be dead people.
Right. And under the lens of such, you know, grainy, shuddery kind of shots of just, it's beautiful. I think, so cool. I wouldn't want it any other way, you know. I wouldn't want a Creature of the Black Lagoon today. Maybe, though. I don't know. A remake would not be bad, I feel like. It'd be
no.
Pretty cool source material. Maybe not. Maybe not.
You know, there were a bunch of remakes. They had The Revenge of the Creature, The Creature Walks Among Us.
Wow.
I don't know how good they were. I mean, your remakes always kind of fall off.
I've stuck with the vanilla product here, okay?
My, honestly, when we talk about scary people, scary creature, iconic creature movies, Invisible Man, that was from the 30s.
Yeah.
But that movie is so good. I love really The Invisible is. Man. That one blew my mind.
Man.
And I want to watch that one again.
Yeah. Did they nail, like, you know, creatures or what?
They, I mean, all you got all of them, and they've the perfect casting choices for each of them. Mm-hmm. I mean, Bela Lugosi as Dracula is phenomenal. He'll always be Dracula.
So good, yeah. Well, maybe Christopher Lee, too. I mean, he's great. And Gary Oldman. But we're just talking.
They're just vampires, stuff. Or are they Dracula?
They're Dracula.
See, to me, no, they're just vampires. Dracula will always be Bela Lugosi, right? All right. So we got number three is up next.
Three, yeah.
My number three is a movie I watched just a couple nights ago. I know this one's going to be on your list. This is Rear Window.
Yes. It, yeah.
Where was that one on your list?
It's my number one.
All right. I mean, you know what? Let's save my three then. We'll talk about it once we get to your number one.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So go ahead with your three.
Really? Okay. Back. That's very kind of you. All right. My number three, continuing the trend of monster movies.
Oh, I know where this one's going.
Beware of the Blob.
The Blob is so good. I feel like we might have watched that a long time ago.
Together? We I think kids, we did.
Because we have it on VHS in the basement.
So do I. I got a combo, actually. It must have been Costco or something when I was young. And we got the Blob coupled with, I think it was Godzilla versus Mothman or whatever it is.
Mothra.
Mothra, that's it.
The Blob. Steve McQueen. You cannot go wrong with Steve McQueen.
You really can't. I love the mystery to this thing. You know, I love it's kind of much like Alien. It's kind of this slowly enveloping, you know, enveloping kind of sense of mystery. You know what I mean?
It's just, I mean, it's supernatural.
Yeah.
All these other ones, there's like a possibility that it's something from Earth, but the Blob is, I mean, quite. It's in the title. It's a blob.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know what it is.
It really is.
We just know that it can consume everything. And mm-hmm. my favorite line from the movie is "The diner's on fire."
Oh my gosh.
It's said with no emotion. I don't remember who says it, but this is when the Blob is like enveloping the entire diner.
But that kind of deadpan, like lines like that,
yeah,
fits so
I
well.
I think it was like maybe the fire chief or something. He just seems so crestfallen and forlorn.
Yeah.
And he didn't have any passion. Poor it's guy. Like he'd given up. And he said, you know what?
He was just
the Blob is going to take the whole town.
He was going to hit retirement pretty soon. And he's like, oh man. Yeah, I love the simplicity in the Blob. But I love the complexity too. I love the way it's designed. You know, there's something just so, I mean, off about it. Not off, but I mean,
but
it's
definitely
just,
it's, off.
Yeah, definitely.
It's out of this world.
That's for sure. It really does feel like something out of this world. It's
it
the
is.
The way it moves.
Isn't it a meteor that lands?
It's a meteor.
It oozes out. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it
kills a dog.
It kills a dog, I think, and then it messes up the guy's hand, right?
Oh, that's right.
The old man is like, "What's going on?" They try to get them to a hospital, and it's just, it's cool because it takes that small town fear, you know what I mean? It really doesn't leave the town.
No.
Really. In fact, I think Not that we know, but it's, that's why I always thought the last shot in the movie was always kind of a breath of fresh air, because I remember it was in the sky, right? And it's something, takes you out of that town that they're in, you know what I mean? And it, you know, takes you out of this almost claustrophobic kind of fear. But it's not totally claustrophobic. I think, you know, it's very emblematic of 50s culture, too, you know, because like we were just saying, it's, you got your movie theaters, you know, you got your diners, and, but it takes all these things that, were so, they were big staples of 50s culture, spins it on its head, mm-hmm. and says, instill this, a little fear in this, right?
Yeah.
And it does it very well. It's a haunting movie. really
blob.
Yeah,
love it.
All right, well, moving on to my number two is
or should I go my turn number two?
Oh, we're not gonna do the first three or... No, we're trying to land in my spot.
Yeah, okay. So we're saving Rear Window.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah,
it's all right. Back to number two for me. Yeah. You might have this one on your list too. This is North by Northwest.
I don't actually. I would love it.
Love this movie. Okay, and similar to these other ones.
I do love this movie.
I haven't seen this one in a little while.
Yeah.
But I just remember so many things I love about it. I mean, you have your climax at Mount Rushmore.
Mm-hmm.
Hitchcock loves his big sets. I mean, Saboteur ended up on the Statue of Liberty. That was awesome. Mount Rushmore is just taken to the next level.
I'm gonna go back to this actually. This his fixation on set pieces.
Yeah,
with Rear Window. But I keep going.
Yeah. So I mean, my favorite scene that I always remember is the one with the crop duster. Had the plane just flying overhead and coming back around and stuff, trying to attack him and kill him. And it's a cool espionage movie. You have your double crossers, your backstabbers.
Yeah, I think it's the premiere.
You've got your Hitchcock blonde who turns on him too.
Right.
Temporarily at least.
Kind of like, ooh, like,
you got a little spice in the mix.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's so good. Like, I mean, I love the attitude that it has, you know what I mean? Yeah, it kind of launched, I guess. Not launched, but it really, like I said, it was the tip-top of, the spy espionage movies, you know what I mean? Which capitalized on the fear of...
And that one definitely put Hitchcock on the map. Not that he wasn't already making great stuff. I mean, that was just a huge blockbuster hit for him.
And for good reason, too, you know? Not much more I can say about it. Other than I really, really like this movie. I regret not putting it on my list.
It's okay.
A crime. And,
that's why we both have lists, and we don't know what's on them, so we can pick up each other's slack.
This has been a revelation for me. I'm like, North by... Yeah, absolutely.
So what do you got for number two?
My number two is Harvey.
Harvey.
Which I am just a...
The horse.
Totally in love with. Harvey the horse? No, sir.
Not that Harvey?
No, it's Harvey the bunny.
Oh, that's right.
Mm-hmm, with James Stewart.
What am I thinking of then? What's the horse movie?
Yeah, Black Beauty.
No. There's a talking horse.
American Beauty. No, I'm just kidding.
It's like an old movie with a talking horse. I thought that was Harvey.
No. Howard the Horse.
Well, okay. You go on. I'll figure out what's driving me insane right now. So.
Harvey is a really clever kind of movie. And, for anybody listening, I'm sure they're aware. It's James Stewart who claims that he can see this rabbit, right? And, everywhere he goes, here's Harvey, but no one else sees him. And so, James Stewart is perceived as this totally normal guy, except when it comes to Harvey, and that keeps undermining his normalcy. It's I like the fact that it is a nice blender of the comical and the drama.
Yeah.
And
James Stewart.
And James Stewart.
That's all you need in a movie to make it gold.
That's right. And James Stewart is so good at portraying kind of a man under collapse. You see that in... Mr. Smith Goes to Washington, and what's funny here is that Harvey, I don't think it's necessarily a collapsible kind of character. I feel like he's pretty well off, but the problem is that, the thing is that he's fine with Harvey. The Harvey's not really detrimental to his being,
right?
But other people around him, because they're so bothered by the fact that he sees this thing, are bothered by it, and so they bring it upon him. They bring, misfortune upon him for it. And again, the 50s with its, spotlight on culture all the time, with its, almost parody of what's perceived to be normal. This is another example of that, because, I love movies that are set in a neighborhood, because neighborhoods are automatically, I think, going to be a great setting for a movie.
Sure.
Because there's just so much weirdness to kind of draw from, and Harvey does that with skill. It's a great movie. What were you thinking of, by the way?
I don't know. I still don't think I can find it. I came up with some movie called Hot to Trot from the 80s with Talking Horse. Maybe I'm insane. I don't know. I swear it was some movie...
Maybe you got your own kind of horse that you see.
Black and white. I don't even know. Maybe I'm just imagining a movie that I could make. It's a black and white movie with a talking horse.
I just had a vision right here in this podcast. That's,
we're on the cutting edge over here.
That's right.
All right. So and along the lines of cutting or talking animals, my number one, going back to Disney. Yeah. I promise, guys, this is the last decade with Disney at the number one movie.
Yeah.
But Alice in Wonderland.
Mm-hmm.
Easily one of the greatest Disney movies. I mean, it's an acid trip, isn't it?
I would say so. Yeah.
It's so wild. It's so out there. I've always had fleeting memories of all these different scenes they do.
Yeah.
They've got the one with the clams. Like, where does that even come from? The whole Tweedledee Tweedledum story about the guys that are fishing for the clams, and the guy eats them all, and then the other guy attacks and kills them. It's like, that's in a kid's movie. It's really cool.
Yeah.
Just a side story. You have Absalom, the...
Absalom, yeah.
Our favorite caterpillar.
Who are you?
It's so good.
It's so cool. It's funny how no movie does it like Alice in Wonderland. Oh. No, like, you can't, like, say... Like, I think a lot of, like, portrayals of Alice in Wonderland in media miss the mark. Absolutely. They miss the mark. They miss what's good about Alice in Wonderland. What's good about it? You named it. It's the dreamlike quality.
It's so fantastical. It's so... I mean, it's slightly based in reality, as is every movie, but it strays so far from it. You've got foods that make you bigger and smaller. You've got talking doorknobs.
Mm-hmm. But it's these playing with the senses that are just, it's so, I mean, out there, you know. It's,
you got singing flowers. That was a cool part, too.
Oh, that's a great part.
Everything about that
movie. They're baby flowers, aren't they?
There's babies, there's adults. The adults are leading, like, a choir of the babies singing, too.
Mm-hmm. It's just and awesome. And that's my favorite incarnation of that story.
Because there's been another...
There's been
Alice in Wonderland remakes.
Well, yeah, and there's just quite a few, but it's the one that got it right.
Yeah,
like, you know, and there's a reason that version always persists. You know, Tim Burton's was a hit at the box office, but
God bless you for trying. But
hey, I remember you saw that together
or whatever, the giant dragon, which is from the book, but you know, that original one's best.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually prefer to watch the movie on VHS. I feel like that format just supports the look of it the best. You know, there are a lot of movies like that. But, Peter Pan is another one.
Peter Pan is a great movie too.
It's, also, my honorable mentions for the '50s, which we'll go to.
We'll get that later this week.
If you're a Peter Pan guy like me,
I don't think anyone's
come
not.
Come on over, yeah. No, how can he not be? Peter Pan. '50s was a great decade for Disney. Some would say. Best with the launch of Disneyland, I feel like, you know, that's he was an empire. Have you seen Saving Mr. Banks?
No,
you haven't seen it.
I'm not entirely interested in it.
Why? You love why? It's so up. It's so you. It's so up your alley. Like,
I don't know. Something about it, just not. It's not doing it for me.
You don't like the melodrama? I thought it was excellent. I think it's one of the best of last year. But we're on my number one now, right?
My number one. Yeah, let's do it. You're number one. My number three.
Yeah, Rear Window. Rear Window is for the '50s. What Citizen Kane was for the '40s. Rear Window was another shot of adrenaline, I feel like, in cinema. In terms of how you take the cinematic language, like I said last episode, and you refine it and you make it whole.
Yeah.
I mean, look at the opening shot of Rear Window. You know, you see just this floatiness to it. It's just this intricate, intelligently designed kind of shots that, I mean, just are everywhere in the movie.
Yeah.
You know, Hitchcock is the real deal. He's not.
He reinforces that with every movie. I'm such a sucker for sets.
Absolutely.
For iconic sets. I mean, and if we're talking Hitchcock, we got Psycho. We have the house and the Bates Motel from Psycho.
Yeah.
I can spot those anywhere, and I love that about the TV show Bates Motel is that they, I don't know if they use the exact same, but it's as close as I've ever seen.
It's a lot like it.
And I mean, I saw the inside of that house, and I knew right away, wow, this is the house from Psycho.
Mm-hmm.
And that street that, I mean, it's artificial, but you have that back alley enclave, if you will, of apartments. That set is one that I'm going to remember for the rest of my life.
I love the artificial look of it though, like, and with Rear Window too. I love
the fact that it doesn't even look artificial to me though. I didn't even know that until I looked
it up. It doesn't, later. But to me, there's this I don't know, there's something kind of dreamy about it.
Yeah.
Know?
Oh yeah.
And I like that though. I love
that's the how fact the 50s is for us anyway.
It's its own little matrix in there, and yeah. The whole complex of you know, people living.
Nothing on the outside of that apartment complex matters yeah. to the story whatsoever. I mean, you have people, but they only matter when they're there.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's, with the police, they're not important until they get there to make the save.
That's exactly right. And again, kind of like what we had just been talking about. It's, listen, you know, there are movies that are a little more free-flowing, they're a little more airy in their yeah. ambitions. But this, I mean, Hitchcock had clearly had an objective with this movie.
Yep.
And he nailed it, you know. And a lot has been said about Rear Window. You know,
it's you've
a
got, celebrated movie. You've got your, you got the confinement theme, both mm-hmm. in the audience and the set, and James Stewart being confined to his yeah. apartment. Yep. And then there's the whole voyeurism, which is mm-hmm. pretty cool. I love how his maid keeps telling him that he's going to get in so much trouble for it. She's like, right. oh, there's trouble. And he's just, I mean, he's just looking out the window.
Right.
So how commonplace is that for us? Everyone mm-hmm. loves people watching.
Yeah. And
that's what that movie is.
Yeah, there's an honesty there, too. You know, yeah. I mean, about people watching and how we're, you know, it's almost kind of, I think people should watch it today, especially just because of how nosy we are
yeah.
in this day and age.
I mean, if you are looking into your neighbor's window, I wouldn't recommend using binoculars or a high-powered lens.
No. This is why I always said that the 50s was the... It's the start of the modern world.
Yeah.
Because the 50s, socially, it was kind of... I think we're still kind of in a similar place.
Sure.
Right? You know, there's... we're fascinated by other people. You know? And so, for a movie like Rear Window to come along and... kind of really talk about, you know, personal living and things like that. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, it's great. And you have the, of course, the imagery of James Stewart looking out the window and you seeing all these little stories in these little compartments.
Yep.
You know?
Everyone living their own life.
And that's kind of a weird concept, isn't it? You know, yeah. The fact that, I mean, you know, you and I live in the same street. We have these different little planets, yep. you know, across, just across the line, and these small spaces, it's amazing.
And the fact that it's all through the lens of James Stewart, mm-hmm. his character. I mean, the yeah. character, the other characters, you've got Miss Lonely Hearts, you've right. got Miss Torso, yeah. I believe is what they call the one girl.
Yeah.
He does know the name of the murderer and his wife.
He does, yeah.
I don't exactly remember how, but yeah, it's just... It's a great movie if you yeah, haven't seen it.
It's a great play of perspective, and it's yeah, it's my number one. 50s. There are so many great movies of the 50s. I just feel like this was really raising the bar. It was pushing it.
Is that the first movie to appear on both of our lists?
Today for the just for the 50s
altogether? Because I don't think we had any in common.
No, 40s. I don't think we did. Yeah,
that's
because I you know I should have had the Devil Bat.
Yeah, we've seen that like, though. What so that's under. Nah, we got to watch that.
All right. Well, now we're into the music.
Spin it into my world. if you'll allow.
I will.
All right.
I will.
So music, like I said, well, for Andrew, for you, it was easier. For me, it was harder because yeah. I mean, I have my preliminary playlist on my personal Spotify account. I've got 16 tracks, mm-hmm. which is almost as many artists, and I have to narrow that down to 5, which is
yeah.
tough.
Yeah.
But I did it.
I'm proud.
I'm proud of you for getting it done, too.
Mm-hmm.
We got 5 this time.
Last minute. But
hey, well, it was last minute, but we're here.
Yeah.
Why don't you kick us off with number 5?
Are you sure? Okay.
Yeah.
My number 5 is Jerry Lee Lewis.
That's a
mouthful for me.
It is.
The double L's, but here it is. Jerry Lee Lewis. You got the playlist, right?
We got Great Balls of Fire.
Great Balls of Fire, of course.
It's a great song.
It really is. Great Balls of Fire. Okay, I'll be honest with you guys. I'll be honest. Okay, I'm going to come clean.
Please do.
I think Goose's version is the best.
Goose.
Top Gun.
I think we need to have a Top Gun exclusive episode at some point too.
I'd agree with you there.
To settle the score.
I was joking, but I really do think Goose is he really put in a lot of heart in that.
Goose.
No, okay. I love Top Gun.
Top Gun, man.
That's a great scene. Jerry Lee Lewis. What a guy. What a guy.
A weirdo.
He's a weirdo.
I mean, there's a lot of weirdos.
But that's okay.
Yeah.
Okay?
For our purposes, it is. For him, it was not okay. I mean, it ruined his career.
Would you say the first weirdo?
What?
The first weirdo.
Was he the first weirdo?
He's the first weirdo. Absolutely He's not. The first public weirdo.
No. I don't know about that. There have been a lot of... I mean...
Okay, well, who in the 40s was a weirdo?
You're asking me these tough questions off the top of my head. I couldn't tell you. I mean, you got Jack the Ripper, if you want to go back even farther.
Well, hey.
There's your original weirdo. Son of Sam. When was he? You got the lipstick killer. These guys are from old eras, 40s, 50s. Those are weirdos.
Yeah, those are weirdos. You know, I'm talking like...
If you guys don't know why he's a weirdo, let me explain this to you. He's been married 7 times. Nothing wrong with that. Well, I mean, there is something wrong with that. That's an opinion thing, though. Maybe you're okay with it. That's fine. One of his marriages, I want to say second or third, was to his 13-year-old cousin. That's the one that brought him a lot of controversy.
Yep. And a label dropped him.
Blacklisted from the radio.
Yep.
It's crazy stuff.
Jerry Lee Lewis.
But hey, great song.
He's great, though. You know, his fiery, if you will, performances were always good.
Passionate spirit.
We were just listening to the live version of Great Balls of Fire, and
that's the one that's going to be on the playlist. It's
heated. It's heated. Yeah,
it's fired up, if you will.
Yeah, but look at him. It's almost impossible to not think of visually who he was too, because you see the hair just flopping around, and his. He's got pretty defined features in his face, so when he's angry, or not angry, but fired up, you could say.
He did, yep.
It really
looks like he fits the mold for weirdo very well.
Yeah. Good guy.
And, it works for his music. So, my number five, we've got the legend, and this one was so tough, because I was trying to pick someone who really laid the foundation for blues. And there's a lot of people out there, but I had to go with Muddy Waters.
Excellent.
And Mannish Boy, which is such a great song. Let's play that for you guys. Man, I love that song so much.
Master the Commander.
So fun.
Really, though, he uses the fact that artists in the 50s were getting a little more playful, right?
And I'm pretty sure it's a play on another song. I don't remember who made the original. Maybe Bo Diddley's I'm a Man.
Yeah.
And this is Mannish Boy, so he's kind of poking fun at him. But he's talking about his rise to manhood. And you got the cheering girls. It's perfect.
It really is.
It's a great song. You got your blues experience. Progression.
Mm-hmm.
Everything about it is.
But there's something about him. I mean, it's just he's taking it along for a ride. It's I'm coming to my world. And so, he's great. I love, that classic blues progression. Where did that start? Like, I don't know.
It started down in some swamp somewhere.
Probably. Yeah, it must have.
Who knows where it started?
Wall.
Yeah. But it changed the world.
Yeah. It's pretty great. He really does. I mean, he's got a pretty... I mean, I was joking about the Master Commander, but, he's got a commanding...
Much so. Him and Howlin' Wolf, both just such a commanding presence.
Yeah. Yeah. And he's a, kind of a do-what-you-want kind of artist, too.
Yeah.
And jazz is a good platform, I feel like, for that kind of thing. More so even, I think, than rock and roll at the time. Rock and roll was great for liveliness, but it was, jazz, I don't know, there's a mold there, but it's, you defined yourself,
Right.
So, great stuff. My number four, my number four? I don't even remember.
I don't know the order you have yours in, so.
Alright, well, it may surprise you. No, it's, this will not surprise you in the least. It's Elvis Presley.
See, and I have Elvis at number one.
Do you really?
I do. Do you want to save him for number one?
We'll pull rear window there.
Yeah. Okay. So we'll go to... let's go down the line. Next would be my number four.
Yeah.
Which my number four, if I can find it... this one is a duo. I love me some duos. This is the Everly Brothers.
Oh, great.
They really personified the 50s sound for me. And this track is called Bye Bye Love. You'll probably recognize it.
Mm-hmm.
For me, the hardest part about putting the Everly Brothers on this list was just deciding what song to use.
Yeah.
Because there's that one, The one about Dream. All I have to do is Dream, Wake Up Little Susie.
Yeah.
They're all so good. They all sound perfect for the decade.
Yeah. I have a hard time myself choosing songs. And some of them I'm like, they're kind of spur of the moment kind of things. But that is a good representation of who they were. I mentioned while you were playing it that, you know, it's Beach Boys before they're the Beach Boys, right?
Sure. It does have that feeling.
Which is good. I'm certain that they took inspiration from the Everly Brothers, and there's no question, I think, you know.
Yeah.
When was that song released?
I'm not sure. Probably, my guess would be like 54 or something along those lines.
Yeah, that's pretty telling of innovation, where it was going, you know. Good guys. I actually don't know much about them at all.
I don't either. Just a couple of brothers.
Probably
some good old boys.
Our research is pretty up there, I think.
Hey, you know what? All the research I need is that they're a couple of little. They look like a couple of teen hunks. So
yeah,
I mean, you had your kind of your teen stars around this time.
Yeah,
people like Paul Anka.
Yeah.
It's always cool to have a family band.
That's an interesting thing, is because I would say that boy bands were invented in the 50s, you know, and now they've kind of, yeah, they're reincarnated today. You know, I'm sure One Direction actually had the same souls of the Everly Brothers. They're just different bodies, but no, but same kind of fandom too. I'm surprised we didn't hear a lot of screaming girls.
Well, that wasn't a lot. Just like,
I mean, you can have Mudslinger.
Mudwaters. Mudslinger.
I want to say Mudslinger. You had the cheers for him, but what about Everly? Okay.
Oh, if you were to watch a live recording, you know there's going to be cheers.
Yeah, I'm just saying, bring him in the studio. What's the problem?
Hey, I don't know. They'd probably go crazy and attack him. We don't want that.
Well, maybe.
We want a lot of hits.
You know, put him behind the glass.
Plus, I know this was one of their first big hits.
Yeah.
It was honestly, one of their biggest singles, too, and one of the first for them that really put them on the map. So maybe before then they didn't have screaming fans that they could bring into the studio.
Well, they should have. I mean, that sounds pretty ahead of its time. It sounds more like a 60s melody to me.
Almost, you know? Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
It's good stuff.
Yeah, well, where are we at now? It's my number three, right? My number three?
Yes, sir. What do you got?
I got Sam Cooke for number three.
Love it. This works perfectly. Well, kind of. My number two is Sam Cooke.
Excellent.
So I think it's worth playing two different Sam Cookes. So we'll start with yours. Yeah. So that was What a Wonderful World by Sam Cooke.
It really makes me
happy.
He's
so optimistic in his music.
Yeah, that's the word I'm looking for, is optimistic, I think. You know, it's the sun's going down and had a pretty good day. It's only going to get better.
Yep.
I love his the levels on his melodies, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
He did not, I mean, from as far as I can tell, I don't think he was like anybody else in that time, you know.
No.
His voice is perfectly paired, I think, with a melody like that.
To me, he seems kind of like the opposite of Elvis.
Yeah.
Because Elvis was taking black music and bringing it to the white people.
Mm-hmm. And then
Sam Cooke was talking the opposite, because here's a black guy who's doing all the white people's style of music.
Yeah.
And he honestly does it better than almost all of them, so
I would agree.
He deserves to be on these lists.
Yeah, there's a nice softness to his voice.
Yeah.
Know, where a lot of, I think, black people were pushed to go a little more, I don't know, heavy or something with their vocals.
We heard Muddy Waters.
Yeah, exactly.
So much more commanding, but mm-hmm. Sam Cooke is, I mean, it's welcoming.
But it's nice when they can break that, I don't know, that expectation from them based on their race, you know what I mean? So
It was an interesting time in the 50s, because you had kind of the music blending, like we saw in our honorable mentions from last week with Bing Crosby and Louis Armstrong working mm-hmm. together.
Yeah.
Things were flipping and flopping, and
we
kind of had the wall being torn down between the two top radios.
It's for the best. When I listen to Sam Cooke, I like to actually pull up an image of his face and just stare at it as I listen.
It's perfect.
I think it's always good to know the face behind your music.
Oh, yeah.
You know what I mean? I like to imagine that same face working in the studio. You know, I do wonder, what was Sam Cooke like in the studio? You know? I think we're due for an interview with Sam Cooke.
Can we get him in? Posthumous interview. Yeah. It's going to be difficult.
A little bit. Make it happen. We're pioneers, remember?
Sure, yeah. We'll get back to you with that one.
Hey.
So my number three is one of the guys who died the day the music died. This is Buddy Holly. And you have him on your list?
All right. Yeah.
I think he deserves two plays, too. Where's he at on yours?
He's my number two. Holly is my number two on my list.
Well, then that works perfectly. Should we do a doubleheader? Should we just get one song? Because my three, your two, they're going to go right in a row. We could just have a doubleheader for...
All right, yeah, let's do a doubleheader, yeah.
So my song is not Fade Away. I love this one. It's covered by the Rolling Stones, but this is the Buddy Holly version.
Mm-hmm.
I love that song.
I wish it was there, like, when Buddy Holly's, like, first good, like, popular single came on the radio.
Yeah.
I wish it was there in, like, just an American family's living room when that happened. That would have been a really eye-opening experience. Yeah, Buddy Holly has got such clean... He's got a cleanliness to his style.
He's got the glasses, which make him seem meticulous, whether he was or not.
What's that?
He's got the glasses.
Oh, the glasses make it. You know, I can imagine...
How many artists had glasses before him? Come to mind?
Nothing. No.
I'm drawing a blank.
Yeah.
He might have personified that. You had Elvis Costello later.
Yeah, but...
You got Moby... Far off in the future, obviously.
You know,
but
come back to you, Moby. It's all good. Yeah, Buddy Holly. Yeah, I love his image. You know.
Yeah.
I'm glad we had those dogs.
We got a barking dog in the background. Let's take you to another Buddy Holly song while we figure out what's going on. This one is Every Day. It's another great hit.
That's one of my all-time favorites right there, for obvious reasons. I'd say Buddy Holly's probably my favorite vocalist of the 50s.
Yeah.
Just because, I mean, there's something about him. I actually find that recently I've been recording my own songs and I've been trying to kind of find my own voice. And there's some kind of familiar ground I find with Buddy Holly.
Yeah.
The fact that, I mean, yeah, there's this playfulness to him, you know, and he doesn't... It's hard to explain. You got to help me out here because it's... I don't want to use the word theatrical again, but there's just this...
His voice, to me, is... It's boyish and hopeful.
Boyish. That's great. Whereas Elvis is more...
Elvis is
masculine. He's a man.
I can't wait to get to Elvis, because I love Elvis.
Yeah, but I love the soft, boyish...
Buddy Holly's got a much more innocent
mm-hmm.
feel.
Yeah.
And it didn't help that he died in that plane crash. And cut his career so short.
Yeah, man, I mean...
But, I mean, that kind of immortalizes him as a boy.
Absolutely.
Even though, I mean, he was an adult, but...
Yeah, but no, I know what you mean. Because I can't imagine... Yeah, because I think artists can be sometimes corrosive to their career in the past.
If you don't mind, I'd like to quote Batman here and say, you either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain.
That is...
Think of how many people... Jerry Lee Lewis we just talked about.
Yeah.
Elvis.
Right.
With his overdosing and whatnot.
And that's too bad, because I feel like Elvis was really...
Elvis was great, but his image in the 70s just went so down. I mean, he was getting so fat, and he was wearing all the rhinestones.
Yeah, I think it's over, yeah.
He did become the villain.
It's a good rise and fall story,
I think. But, I mean, for all those believers out there, he could still be alive reshaping that image, right?
Oh, I didn't tell you? I saw him. just outside my... It was kind of weird. He was on my window.
Oh, okay.
It was lightning out. It was a storm. And every time that the lightning would strike, it would illuminate the window.
Did you say anything? See him right there. Thank you very much, or anything like that?
No, I didn't. I think he lost his voice, actually, which is too bad.
Well, we'll get to Elvis in a bit. That was your number two.
Yeah.
Buddy Holly.
Can I say one more thing about...
Absolutely, yeah.
That song, for me, there's this great progression there that I really like, you know, and the production is so crisp. Do you notice that?
Yeah.
It must be a remaster or something, because it just sounds so good.
More than likely.
But matched with the, you know, whatever it is, the bells that they're using, the, you know, it's an iconic beat, and there's nothing quite, I thought I had something more to say. I can't.
Buddy Holly, leaving us speechless.
I love Buddy Holly. Buddy, listen.
All right.
I love you. You're great.
We miss you, buddy.
Yeah.
My number two, back to Sam Cooke. I don't think there's a wrong time to listen to Sam Cooke.
Never. No.
This is You Send Me. That was the first Sam Cooke song that I knowingly heard when I was taking a history of rock and roll in college.
Yeah.
And I say that as if it was a decade ago. It's like 2 years. But, wow. I mean, that is the 50s. That song right there is the whole 50s pop progression, everything. It's just,
yeah,
he nails it down.
Yeah. He's good at nailing nostalgia, too. You know?
And he's got the vocals for it.
Mm-hmm. I would have done anything to see, like, a live performance of him at some point, you know?
He's another one of those guys, unfortunately, that was cut short.
That's right.
Like Buddy Holly.
Like so many. And
I believe the story with that, for those who don't know, he was at a hotel and he was accused of robbing the safe or something. And
yeah,
the hotel manager shot him. Just straight up, whatever.
Yeah, that's not right.
Awful.
Yeah.
Obviously was not him, but
yeah,
he lost another great one.
He's no thief, and but not to make light of
his death. He has stolen a few hearts, I'm sure.
Oh, I'm sure.
He's got my heart.
That's what I'm saying, like, you know, is that he calls for a kind of live performance, you know what I mean? He calls for that giving back, that back-to-back communication between the artist and the listeners, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It almost seems like, listening to his recordings, he's calling out for something, you know, there's a yearning in his music, you know, everywhere it is. I mean, there's just, I don't know. He's great. And I wish he were still alive.
I think we all do. So what do you got? Number one. Where are we at?
Number one is, it's a little later in the 50s, and I think the music actually is not that 50s-ish, but it's Miles Davis.
Miles Davis. We got So What from Kind of Blue. Here we go. Talk about cool jazz.
Talk about it. Yeah, it's... Why I love Miles Davis is, and the reason I chose that song, you know, it was definitely tough for me, but the reason I chose that one is that his first songs are always so essential in his albums, because Miles Davis, I feel like, helped define what an album was, where you're stepping into my world now, okay, definitely. And come around for the experience. And if, in terms of putting you in a time and a place, no one really does it like Miles Davis, you know, in terms of... jazz. We talked about last episode how listening to Sinatra, it's almost like, I don't know, I really feel like I'm there in New York City and
right.
You know, it's cool out. And Miles Davis does that for me. It's funny because where a lot of 50s music will place me in that time,
yeah,
you know, Miles Davis really actually puts me in more of a 40s kind of time set where it's, you know, it's film noir, it's detective.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's such a slickness. That is, and you said you don't have Miles Davis in yours because you feel like it's timeless.
I don't. I need to give you guys all a disclaimer about jazz music. I'm a huge fan of jazz, and Miles Davis is incredible. Sketches of Spain is probably my favorite jazz album, period. But I can't rightfully put him or any other artist. I had Dave Brubeck in some of these preliminary lists. I had Tito Puente.
Yeah.
All these people that I could put on the list. I just don't feel like jazz can be pinned to any decade.
Yeah.
Because even when you listen to like this, if you were to tell me this was recorded a year ago, I'd believe it.
Yeah,
because it sounds, jazz is just, it escapes time completely.
Yeah.
It's all about place.
I could agree. And I think especially with Miles Davis, jazz actually, I think, has become a way of life. You know, not in the general, like in the typical sense, but I'm talking about jazz is the experience of listening to it. It becomes even more than that sometimes. It's a lived in kind of state of mind. You know what I mean? When I'm in a jazzy kind of mood, you know, it's, I don't know, it's behaviorally it'll affect you, I think. You know,
sure.
And again, at the expense of sounding a little dramatic, you know, it's just, that's what it does. That it instills such a strong mood in you.
Yeah.
You know, there is no question about what the feelings that it's trying to elicit, you know. And that's why I love it, is I think jazz is one of the most it's one of the purest genres there is, you know, because it's so...
People would not have agreed back then.
Right.
There was such a split between classical and jazz.
It's crazy.
And all the adults thought jazz was some kind of hip, crazy... Basically, parents back then thought of jazz what parents today think of rap.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it was just too unpredictable, I guess, was the big issue. But
it's so funny, but, like, I mean, it's one of those genres that just really understood its aesthetic, you know? And it said, okay, it's almost like, you know, it's almost like Hitchcock with Rear Window. He knew what he was trying to say.
Yeah.
You know, and jazz knew...
Miles Davis for sure is... I think it could be called the Hitchcock of jazz.
Yeah, no, I would agree totally. I mean, I think, yeah, he, for me, like, yeah, he's one of the headliners of jazz.
Without a doubt.
In a different way, too, you know, you don't hear a lot of, you know, I mean, he's unpredictable in the fact that where are the vocals, right? It defies kind of the usual structure of jazz. Even though you were just saying that jazz doesn't really abide by much rules at all.
It's not supposed to be. It's all...
Yeah.
Intentionally.
Whereas I would argue, I think jazz today actually kind of has fallen a little bit into a formula. It's not really bad or anything. I'm just saying it, you know, it has.
Yeah, I could see that.
But Miles Davis is no one quite like him.
I'd love to, at some point down the road, do a jazz-only episode.
That'd be good. Yeah. That'd be good.
Because I've got a lot of jazz to get off my chest.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Love me some jazz music. So that was your number one. Yeah. My number one... We've already alluded to this man many times. This is Elvis Presley.
Hey, hey, hey.
Myth, the legend in his prime. This is an early song for him, and it doesn't sound like Elvis. This is Mystery Train. So I said that it didn't sound like Elvis to me.
Mm-hmm.
The sense that it didn't. I mean, a lot of his other stuff is kind of more rock and roll, pop, and this sounds to me more like a country.
Well, because this is
kind of song.
Yeah, this is early in his career, though, and I think he is still holding on to his...
He started with country music.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, reasonably so. I mean, you know, he was born in Memphis, and it's kind of just what it was all about, right? But he's still... you can even find it as more rock and roll-y kind of music. There's still a tinge of country in there.
The one reason I say it does sound like Elvis is because... In typical Elvis fashion, it is a stolen song.
Yeah.
Not literally stolen, of course, but so many of his hits were previous recordings.
Yeah.
Like Blue Suede Shoes was Carl Perkins. Mm-hmm. This song was originally by someone named Junior Parker. I've listened to that version, and just like with the original version of Blue Suede Shoes, Elvis, he does it better.
Yeah.
It's plain and simple. I mean, he kills it and makes it so accessible.
Mm-hmm.
And...
Yeah,
I mean, this song is just the way he leaves it. It's so, there's nothing to be said about it.
Yeah, he's not
complaints.
Yeah, he's not some cheap trick or anything. I think he really is lives up to his name. Excuse me, his name. But Elvis, I think, is
Elvis the Pelvis.
I used to call him an evil mastermind because
he is.
What kind of guy sits there and says, "Okay, you know, what I'm trying to say is that he engineered his image so well." With the public that instantly, I mean, you know, he gathered, not instantly, but, you know, pretty fast, you know, he gathered a lot of fandom.
Yeah.
And a lot of that, I feel like, from what I see, was him. It was all, Elvis is all him. You know, it's the DIY of music.
He's,
you know?
He's au naturel.
Yeah. And where you see a lot of what I think the fandom of today, like, take a look at Justin Bieber. A lot of why he's famous was not really because of him. It was a lot of management and a lot of, you know, luck and a lot of time and place and things like that. Whereas Elvis came in and he said, okay, I'm going to do my thing, right? He had and I don't know the whole Elvis story, really.
That song was rated number 77 on Rolling Stone's 500 Greatest Songs of All Time.
Mm-hmm.
That's the Elvis version, too.
Yeah.
He is the real deal. If you don't like Elvis, I don't know what to say to you. You should. That's all I could say. He's a cool guy.
Yeah, I don't like this whole thing that's come about saying, well, are you an Elvis guy? You know what I mean? People say that.
You should be.
I'm like, well, we all should be. Like, I mean, as an American, you know, well, really as just anybody, you know, Elvis, you know, was popular really everywhere. Mm-hmm. If you, even if you don't like him, which is already kind of weird, you can't discount his importance
to music in general. Yeah.
So that's, you got to pay your dues. You know, listen to a little Elvis. Do yourself.
Listen to a lot of Elvis.
Yeah.
So there we are. That's the bell's final toll. It's the number one.
The number one. There you have it.
I'm excited for the honorable mentions that we'll do on Friday.
On Friday, yeah, that's the plan. Stevie is so much more organized about this than me. I'm just lost.
You're swirling. You're spinning. You're the spinner.
Yeah, I'm the spinner, and you're the, I don't know.
I'm the spindle. You're spinning around me.
Right.
I have a concentrated spin. It's much more controlled, and you're on the outskirts.
I'm a spiral.
You're a lot faster.
I'm just, yeah. I'm
you think about the Earth. I'm at the core.
Right, I'm on that.
You're on the outside going 80,000 miles an hour, or whatever it is.
I'm just the atmosphere. Yeah, I'm
all loosey goosey.
All loosey goosey. Like,
but that's gonna be a good time.
It really is. And speaking of loosey goosey, get ready for tomorrow. We're gonna have our Top Gun themed episode.
Oh boy,
we
got to do that.
But really,
Top Gun.
Hey, real talk, Stevie. Hey, we're gonna make that happen. Hey.
I'd love to make a Top Gun. Can I guarantee it tomorrow? Absolutely not. But I can guarantee it. Just like the jazz episode, I think we should have a Hitchcock episode. We gotta hit on a lot of these things. Top Gun. Oh boy, should we save that for its era?
No.
Should we do it? Do we need to get it out now?
I guess so. I mean, I'm more of a go with Top Gun.
I feel like anyone who's Top Gun would be go. Isn't that the tagline of the movie? Top Gun. Go, go, go.
Go, go, go. Yeah, I think it's go, Speed Racer, go, Speed Racer, go, Speed Racer, go.
Sure.
That's kind of what we're all about here. Maverick, I would think, was pretty essential to this podcast. And his whole thing.
Are you trying to be a Maverick by putting the Top Gun episode in the 50s?
Yeah. You know, well, let's say, when was Tom Cruise born in the 50s?
Oh boy!
Hey, do a little.
All right, was he? Here's a more important question: did Tom Cruise star in Top Gun when he was born?
Yeah.
I don't think so.
Well, he was born for Top Gun, if that's what you're saying.
He was born in the '60s.
Was he? Okay, that's right, because he's 52 now. I can't. You know, math is.
You know, mad that you know his age, guys. I'm looking at Wikipedia. He is 52.
Hey, you know,
freaking me out.
I'm a fan, and
how are we gonna end the 50s episode talking about Tom Cruise?
Insulting. I realized that I derailed this. But listen, any good thing ends with Tom Cruise. All right. Wait, let me reword that.
Okay. Let's just end it with a cruise in your.
Hey, it's cruise
car control,
baby. Okay,
you're cruising down to the drive-in with your gal. You guys are going steady.
Yeah.
And kick back while the movie spins.
Okay. And what's playing? Hey.
Who knows?
Hey.
Close your eyes, you tell me.
Whoa, it's A Few Good Men.
It's not. We're in the 50s. Stop. You will be the death of this podcast.
All right, well, that's the end of our Tom Cruise fan cast episode 2.
Please, never another Tom Cruise.
Please, always... calling out to you, Cruise. Come for me.
You're reaching out. Jack Reacher. You're reaching out to Tom Cruise.
I'm a believer. We need Stevie on board with this. He can be your wingman. I can too. We'll have a little trio going
on. We need Hitchcock to direct a movie explaining how it is we arrived at Tom Cruise from a 50s podcast.
Oh my gosh. Hitchy.
Hitch, help us.
We need
heaven help us.
Take us out of cruise control, Hitch.
Stop.
This is bad.
The cruise puns are unbearable.
Wow, I really don't know how to end this.
We're lost in space.
Wow. Okay. Wow. I got to delete this episode. Wow.
Let's end it with what I think could become a new catchphrase. Keep on spinning.
Keep on spinning.
Get out there. Spin your 50s records. Spin your 50s DVDs. Spin the wheels of your 50s VHSs if you have them.
Yeah.
And
spin a web.
Spin a web.
Spider-Man.
See you. Spider-Man.
See ya.
See you guys later.
Spider-Man. Bye, guys.